systems for health, for food production and distribution, and this will only grow because people are realizing that they can place no trust in authority to look after their interests.
I'm trying to really absorb what you just said there. Thank you for that. And Frahis, let me get a reaction from you, because our guest there said that's good news, that basically not going with establishments and what they're advocating, and for people to create their own independence through whatever routes that at the end of the day brings them some kind of financial stability or income is the way to go. What do you think?
I think there's definitely a place for that. But what's in my mind, so long as the system is in place, it doesn't matter who's elected into that system. I've always viewed it as, you know, the people who say, the reformists who say, vote for me or vote for our party or vote for us, put us in government and we'll carry forward the policies that are going to bring, you know, real wealth distribution among the people. But what happens is they go into the system, then they become part of the system, and eventually they defend the system. And 20 years after they've gone into politics, they become the very people that they first stood outside of Parliament, shouting that these people must go. So unless there's a change of system, then systematically nothing will change. People, I believe, are beginning to awaken to the fact that we are being constantly lied to, constantly misled, and constantly brainwashed by the mainstream media of government propaganda. And I don't have an agenda. I have no axe to grind here. I just see that as one of the biggest kind of blockades and stumbling blocks to any form of real democracy, because we don't live in a democracy. We live in a duopoly between the two major parties. There is no real third party. There's none in America. There's none in Britain. I don't think there's many in Europe. Trump got elected because he was the anti-establishment guy, and it shows that there is a voting base for people who want the system to change. But the system's been there for hundreds of years, and you know, the only way for it to be changed is through some form of social revolution. And what that would take, I'm not 100% sure. But I promise you, those in power, and more importantly, those behind the throne, those behind the power, those with the money and the influence, they would soon have the police and the army on the streets, restoring order and beating their citizens.
Well, when you talk about a social revolution, Clive Menzies, our guest there, mentioned that. And you, Clive, talked about how the good news is that people should establish their own way. It comes at a time when you're looking at a very unstable world altogether, in Europe particularly, with energy prices to have led to this high state of inflation, which for the UK is at the highest in 40 years. Do you still think that the establishment, therefore, should be done away with or not be there? Because, again, it comes at a very sensitive time.
Well, in terms of energy, this has very little to do with the sanctions on Putin and has much more to do with the green agenda and the policies. And as far as the policies that are derived from that fraudulent science that says that the climate is being caused by us, climate change, but we won't get into that. I would say that we're ruled by a kakistocracy. There's a Danish researcher who explained this in 2015, which is effectively ruled by the worst. And when we talk about revolution, I think the last thing we want is uprising on the streets. But there are other factors. When one talks about police or martial law, let's not forget the police have families and friends, and they are similarly affected. So in terms of the future and as regards inflation, the inflation is largely a product of overprinting of currency. In terms of what is going to happen in terms of social revolution, it is basically the fragmenting of institutional hierarchy, where people will turn their backs on authority, be it local government, national government, regional government, and they will turn their backs on the large corporations that merely predate on them, and create their own networks. How long this will take is difficult to say, but there is undoubtedly a seismic shift in the way humans are going to conduct their affairs. And I think we're at a pivotal point where the system or the structure is beginning to dissolve because it no longer has credibility.
Okay, thank you so much. We'll leave it there. That's Clive Menzies from London, political economy thank researcher you. And analyst. Also, thank you, Frau Hughes, journalist, author, and activist from Belfast. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Vitapoe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be asking a question kind of related to the events of the day of Ashura and the Battle of Karbala. This question is kind of related in general terms to a more universal problem, and that is regarding the authenticity of a lot of the events which are narrated from the pulpits regarding, the Day of Ashura and the Battle of Karbala. Specifically, this question is about the event which is often narrated from the pulpits, which says that when the brother of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Abu Fazl al-Abbas, went to the river Furat to fetch water for the children of the Ahlul Bayt, he picked up a handful of water, and then upon remembering Imam Hussein, he threw it away. So the question is that how do we know if this is really true and this occurred when under the circumstances, the assumption is that he went there alone and nobody was with him, nobody was around him at that time. So, how do we know that this event really transpired? In response to this question, we can say that on the day of Ashura and the Battle of Karbala, there were certain individuals, in general terms, who were recording the particulars and the details of what was transpiring in that situation. For example, there was a person named Hamid ibn Muslim. He is one of the transmitters who tangibly and immediately witnessed these events of Karbala. And many of the events of this battle were transcribed in the history, the famous book of history of Tabari and other, historical books. Of course, this person was belonged to the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, historically speaking, right? But nevertheless, other historians have mentioned that, Hazrat Abu al-Fazl Abbas, alayhi salam, he arrived at the river of the Euphrates, and he picked up a handful of water, and upon remembering the thirst of his brother Imam Hussein and the children of the Ahlul Bayt, he threw it down. And, he recited a poem at this time. This poem was heard and transmitted, regarding the fact that, it's not worthy of me to do this, to drink this water when, my brother and, these other people are thirsty. And then upon reciting this poem, he threw the water back into the river, and then he made his way back to the encampments of Imam Hussein, upon which he was attacked by the enemy and he was martyred. This event has been specifically recorded in the famous Maqtal of Muqarram on page 267, the famous book of the events of Ashura, as well as the book Nafasul Mahmum on page 409. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. we were looking at the events of Ashura and their authenticity. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
People from all walks of life rallied in the Gaza Strip following the Friday prayer in solidarity with Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Protesters shouted slogans decrying the Israeli crimes in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank. In recent days, extremist Jewish settlers, backed by Israeli forces, have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli attacks usually increase during Jewish holidays. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the rally, warned the Tel Aviv regime against crossing the red lines at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
Armed resistance is the only choice for Palestinians to fight the occupation. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire by attacking Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds is growing stronger. The Zionists are adding fuel to the fire, and it may only burn them.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to step up their support for Al-Quds until the end of all the Israeli violations in the Holy City. They also reiterated their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds.
We call on all Muslims to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque because it belongs to all Muslims. We call on our brothers and sisters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds to increase armed resistance against the Zionist enemy. The whole world must understand that we are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967, while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state.
We are here today to condemn the continued Israeli attacks against our people in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. The Palestinians are fighting for a just cause, and they will continue to fight until they regain their freedom.
Palestinians maintain that continued Israeli infringements upon Al-Aqsa Mosque will only increase the resistance against the occupation.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds while turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
It's been just a few weeks since the now resigned Prime Minister, Liz Truss, promised low taxes and high growth. Events have moved incredibly fast in Westminster that a new finance minister is now raising taxes and promising public sector cuts. The U-turns and counter-U-turns have come with a cost for the economy and the people. A new study has found that millions of households are skipping meals or struggling to put healthy foods on the table. Inflation is already at more than 10%. Energy and fuel prices are on the rise, putting a squeeze on Britain's finances.
Well, the start of all this is Brexit. Brexit led to Boris and incompetence. It led to falling living standards. It led to Liz Truss and further incompetence. And Britain basically voted to become poorer by leaving the EU. You can blame some of it on money printing at the Bank of England, inflation taking out, you know, and lowering living standards as well. So it's a combination of things.
A combination of things that have toppled two prime ministers in the span of 1 year.
It's been less than 2 months since Boris Johnson gave way to Liz Truss as prime minister, followed by the death of the Queen and a dramatic change in the country's economic outlook. And now yet another leadership contest that could trigger even more economic and political instability.
And more instability means more people relying on charities, from food banks to keep their stomachs full, and warm rooms where those unable to heat their homes can take refuge in the cold months of winter. The new chancellor has curbed Liz Truss's flagship economic plan of a 2-year cap on energy bills to April next year. And at the end of this month, he's expected to announce a midterm economic policy that could spell out the beginning of another prolonged period of austerity.
Whoever takes over, Boris, Rishi, Mordaunt, who knows? But the outlook continues to be bad because inflation is still out of control. There's not the money or the government finances to give the public sector further wage rises to match that inflation. Strikes will continue. The fiscal position of the country remains dire, partly because we have a smaller economy because of Brexit. So there's no easy solution. There's no easy way out of this. The hole has been dug and it's very deep and very difficult to climb out of.
Paying the price of that, ordinary Britons, as the Conservative Party races to choose its third leader and prime minister in 1 year, urgent help to those in need couldn't come any sooner. Sai Purisa, London.
EU leaders at a summit in Brussels agreed China is becoming too assertive. It's the same phrase they have been using for years with respect to Russia. Iran was also in their sights. New restrictive measures against Tehran were rubber stamped.
Sanctions have been taken against those who are participating in the repression of peaceful demonstrations. And this, of course, is linked to the support of Russia against Ukraine.
Analysts say the allegations against Iran are spurious and they are being vehemently contested. It's pointed out that the bloc sometimes ignores clear international law violations, even when there's zero ambiguity. For example, those perpetrated by Israel against Palestinians. The US is set to have even greater influence over the EU as the bloc moves to try and isolate Moscow and Beijing. It's suggested that has been Washington's plan all along.
Europe, they are totally dependent on the United States and in energy field and in military field. And that is dependency that doesn't allow them to conduct independent foreign policies.
Sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have driven energy costs to unmanageable levels. A complex package has been agreed in principle by EU leaders to try and lower prices and demand.
There's a lot of work now ahead of us what the energy is concerned, but the roadmap is very clear. And it was good to have this unanimity, this broad support for the roadmap that we have put forward.
Leaders admit the energy package is very complex and will take up to 3 weeks to try and finalise. Will this summit deliver positive results for EU citizens? It's a crucial question for millions of households and businesses, but also a vital political question for the bloc's leaders. Extreme left and extreme right anti-EU parties are waiting in the wings. Ignoring massive corruption findings by their own financial watchdog, EU leaders have agreed to provide €18 billion to the Ukrainian government in 2023. But that's nothing compared to what they will spend on lethal weapons for the country's army. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A draft law aiming to punish anyone caught wearing a full face covering has been proposed in Switzerland. If passed, Muslim women caught wearing a niqab or a burqa could be fined up to $1,000. A far-right proposal to totally ban facial coverings in public has already become law, winning a narrow victory in a referendum in 2021.
The ban was pushed by the Swiss People's Party, with one of its parliamentarians arguing that the ban would promote equality between men and women and would also help to fight back against so-called Islamic radicalization.
Muslim organizations have expressed concern over rising Islamophobia in Switzerland and condemned the move as hypocritical.
So the Swiss cabinet says that this general ban on face covering is about the safety and safeguarding of citizens. But why not make an exemption for the niqab? I mean, it's not like there's a crime spree of niqabis across the country. That's just ridiculous. And, you know, jokes aside, what is going on here with vilifying a well-known symbol of the Muslim faith is that Muslims would then, as a community, be seen as divisive and criminally minded if we so much as speak up in support of the niqab.
Laws which negatively affect Muslim women are springing up across Europe. France banned wearing full-face veils in public in 2011, whilst Denmark, Austria, the Netherlands and Bulgaria have full or partial bans on wearing face coverings. Muslims make up only around 5% of the Swiss population. Yet, how Muslim women choose to dress remains a major obsession of right-wing lawmakers. Robert Carter, London.
Another Palestinian young man, seen by many as a hero and an icon, has been killed by Israeli forces during a confrontation in the occupied West Bank. For more than 10 days, the regime's forces had been carrying out a manhunt for Uday Tamimi after he shot at an Israeli military checkpoint at the entrance to his hometown, the Shafat refugee camp in Al-Quds. On Wednesday night, he was gunned down during clashes with Israeli forces at the entrance of an illegal settlement in eastern Al-Quds called Ma'ale Adumim. Hearing a call from Palestinian factions, a general strike has been held in Al-Quds and throughout the occupied West Bank to mourn at Tamimi. The walkout affected all public institutions and private sectors, including schools and businesses. Public transportation was also shut down during the strike.
The general strike prevailing today in the occupied territories is a political message that the Palestinian people are standing behind the resistance option and to assert that they are following the footprints of the martyrs until victory and freedom. It's a message that the Palestinian people will not stand with their hands cuffed in front of the Israeli crimes and that they have the right to resist the occupiers.
Palestinian resistance factions have also urged Palestinians to take to the streets to denounce At-Tamimi's killing and the aggression by the Israeli regime. Sporadic protests also erupted in several areas of the West Bank. Protesters said they would offer as many martyrs for the sake of Palestine's freedom while fighting the Israeli occupation. They added that more action is required to respond to Israeli atrocities.
We are united as Palestinian people. We continue to prove that we have a strength to sacrifice our souls. We are ready to go to direct confrontations to resist the Israeli forces. We stand united behind the resistance, behind the confrontations, behind the martyrs.
Israel's escalating repression during the last month is part of a larger operation to quell the growing Palestinian resistance, particularly armed resistance. Recently, many Palestinian youths are drawn to this kind of resistance, with the newly formed group of fighters known as the Lion's Den as an example. Many might question whether a new uprising against Israel is in the making here in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. While the Israeli military is escalating its crackdown against Palestinians and using excessive force to counter the Palestinian resistance, it's obvious that Tel Aviv fears a renewed surge in anti-Israeli operations, especially after a rise in armed attacks against the Israeli regime. Mona Qandil, occupied Al-Bira.
Britain has been thrown into another leadership crisis after outgoing Prime Minister Liz Truss announced her resignation after just 44 days in office. Her departure makes Truss the shortest-serving UK Prime Minister in British history and the fourth Tory to head the troubled nation in just 4 years.
I cannot deliver the mandate on which I was elected by the Conservative Party. I have therefore spoken to His Majesty the King to notify him that I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
So now eyes turn towards who her successor will be. The ruling Conservative Party have chosen to ignore opposition calls for a general election.
This cannot continue. Britain deserves better. Britain cannot afford the chaos of the Conservatives anymore. We need a general election now.
The next Prime Minister is expected to be elected via another internal leadership race within the space of just 1 week. Speculation suggests that past leadership contenders Rishi Sunak and Penny Mordaunt both have their eye on the top job, whilst current Chancellor Jeremy Hunt has ruled himself out of the race. Former Prime Minister Boris Johnson has stunned many with rumours he may attempt a return. Truss's allies claim she stood aside graciously. However, critics believe she should be held accountable for her self-admitted mistakes.
Liz Truss leaving after just 44 days in power really epitomises the state of the current Conservative Party. Because think about it, if after 12 years of power, yet another Conservative Prime Minister is chased out after being unable to clean up the mess that their party created, well, what does it say about any other potential leadership candidate?
Going forward, it's expected things are going to move very rapidly, with Tory MPs expected to put forward their nominations on Monday, with an election process concluded by Friday the 28th, and with a new Prime Minister in place in time for October the 31st's fiscal statement. However, it's surely going to take much more than a speedy election process to restore the nation's lost confidence in the ruling Conservative Party. Robert Carter, London.
A once foreign minister, Amir Abdullahian, has paid a visit to EP House, an NGO supporting patients suffering from a rare skin disorder that causes the skin to become fragile, known as epidermolysis bullosa. During the visit, which came on the occasion of the EP Awareness Week, Iran's top diplomat said imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights.
Imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights. There are 1,300 EB patients in Iran, but Sweden refuses to give special bandages to these patients. This comes as Westerners have repeatedly declared that sanctions do not include patients and medicine, but in practice, they act the opposite.
The Swedish company Mölnlycke Healthcare has refused to sell Iranian EB patients medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation.
Iran has serious problems in procuring wound dressings for EB patients. These dressings are produced in Sweden, but the country refrains from providing us with the bandages because of the U.S. sanctions. Our center has filed a lawsuit in the judiciary of the Islamic Republic to pursue the problem, and we expect the Foreign Ministry and the administration of President Raisi to follow up the case because the lives of my daughter and other patients are in danger.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items. Tens of Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Swedish company Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran. Since then, for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%. Iran says the West is taking revenge on Iranians by waging a campaign of genocide against patients, believing that the sanctions have become the backbone of the so-called American human rights regulations. Saman Kujurib, Tehran.
A high-ranking Palestinian delegation has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Arriving from Algeria, officials discussed the result of their meetings there for reconciliation among Palestinians. Assad underlined the importance of unity among Palestinians as a source of strength in the face of the Israeli aggression and for regaining their rights. He asserted that Syria will always remain in support of resistance against Israel. Members of the delegation expressed appreciation for Syria's historic support to Palestinians, describing it as their safe haven during hardships. They said they stand beside Syria in this years-long war waged by the U.S. and its allies. Following the meeting, representatives of Palestinian factions held a press conference.
The president welcomed us in an open heart and expressed Syria's love to Palestine, Palestinians, Palestinian cause and resistance, as well as determination for this meeting to pave the way for a new phase of relations between Syria and Palestinian factions.
The most significant aspect of the visit was that Hamas officials were present. This is their first visit to Syria in a decade after they left, cutting ties with the Syrian government at the start of Syria's crisis. During the press conference, Hamas officially announced the restoration of relations with Syria.
This is a glorious and important day. We restore our presence in Syria and joint action with Syrian-based Palestinian factions and the Syrian government in support of our cause. We told Assad that we support a unified Syria and we are against any aggression on Syria.
The visit comes shortly after Palestinian factions came together under Algerian Reconciliation Initiative, in which they met and agreed to end disputes and division for the sake of unifying ranks in the face of Israel. Palestinian factions' visit to Syria reiterates the Arab country's pivotal role in supporting Palestinian resistance against Israel, even during the war it is facing. And receiving Hamas officials in Damascus is yet another proof of Syria's commitment to the Palestinian cause, despite Hamas's stance over the Syrian crisis and disagreements in 2012. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen on March 2015, attacks on education centers have severely disrupted access to education. A recent UN report says over 2,900 schools have been destroyed, partially damaged, or used for non-educational purposes. Even though the world body did not mention the cause of the destructions in its report, most of the schools were hit by the Saudi aerial attacks.
Since the beginning of the war against our country, the Saudi-led coalition has been seeking to target the educational system because the enemy realizes the importance of education and its role in the society. So the coalition cut the salaries of employees, including teachers, which negatively affected the country's education. Due to the war, we were only able to print a very small percentage of the textbooks, and the poor living conditions forced many children to leave education and enter the labor market to support their families.
For its part, the International Committee of the Red Cross has urged the international community to save the education system in the country. It says there are over 2 million children out of school and over 8 million students need support to access education.
Over 2 million children don't have access to proper education in Yemen, and one out of four of all primary and secondary schools have been damaged or have been used for purposes other than what they're intended for. This is exacerbated by internally displaced people using some schools as shelters as they are forced to flee from their homes to escape the ongoing conflict. Of course, education will have long-lasting effects and ramifications that will indeed impact the Yemeni people for generations to come.
Structured learning has been further hindered as 172,000 teachers have been irregularly paid since 2016, while some have not been paid at all. Sadly, some teachers could not even cover the transportation costs as they are working voluntarily.
Despite all the challenges, education remains the safety net for future generations. Therefore, Yemenis say they will keep pushing their children to schools, hoping to build a generation that will reconstruct the country after the Saudi-led war. Abdulatif Lwashali, Sana'a.
Leaders meeting with members of the Expediency Council. Two weeks ago, the chairman and members of the Expediency Council met with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. According to Article 112 of the Islamic Republic of Iran's constitution, the Expediency Council has a duty to clarify and decide what is the best course of action to take in cases where the Guardian Council has decided a bill passed by the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, contravenes either Iran's constitution or Islamic Sharia law. The Expediency Council also issues advice as and when needed. When called upon by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The leader also appoints all permanent members and all rotational members of the council. After introducing and remarking about the newly appointed members of the council, Ayatollah Khamenei described the Expediency Council as a very significant and important institution, comprising of scholars, elites, experts, and highly experienced people capable of analysing and providing excellent advice on all issues pertaining to the country, saying the fundamental duties of the Expediency Council are very important. Turning to recent events in Iran, the leader described the scattered and diffused riots as a passive and clumsy plot by the enemy against the progress and the great innovative movements of the Iranian nation. The leader emphasized, "As long as the nation remains faithful to the Islamic system and religious values, then these hostilities will continue, with the only solution being to resist." The leader also emphasized that all officials should be careful and vigilant, that they are not distracted from their primary responsibilities and duties in the domestic and foreign arenas by current events in the country. Ayatollah Khamenei thanked the members for their efforts in the last term of the Expediency Council, especially their efforts with regards to the general policies of the Seventh Plan, and went on to honor the memory of the deceased members of the Council, especially the late Ayatollah Hashemi Shahroudi. The leader said, "The Expediency Council has an esteemed position, both in terms of the presence of elites and experienced people in it, and because of its essential duties." Ayatollah Khamenei described the most critical responsibility of the Expediency Council as a task of determining what is expedient. He has stressed, "The issue of expediency is one of the high-priority issues of the system, and according to the founder of the Islamic Republic, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, the Expediency Council's duties are so vital that neglecting them can often harm Islam." The leader emphasized it is necessary to know the issue and recognize the problem of expediency and added, "In determining expediency, it should be done in an entirely reassuring way." Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei called the correct definition of general policies and up-to-date and guiding framework for laws and executive affairs in order to achieve goals. He added, "Some policies are permanent, but others are specific to a certain period and need to be updated." The leader considered the task of monitoring the good implementation of general policies as a delicate issue. He said, "Sometimes it is complained that this monitoring causes the work to be blocked. At the same time, legal considerations and rules should be taken into account so that monitoring, while preventing the deviation of legislative and executive work, does not cause a stop or delay in the affairs of the council." Effectiveness of general policies was the final point mentioned by the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Ayatollah Khamenei continued to refer to the recent cases and scattered and diffused riots and advised members of the Expediency Council as influential people in reforming affairs and neutralizing the plot of the enemy, to pay enough attention to these issues and not to ignore them, emphasizing that in recent events, the role and involvement of the enemy is evident for all to see. He said even impartial foreign experts admit that these issues are not as spontaneous. Emphasizing that in recent events, the role and involvement of the enemy is evident for all to see, he said even impartial foreign observers have acknowledged and admitted that these events are not spontaneous internal matters. Of course, there may be issues where the public is dissatisfied, but the actions of the enemy, such as propaganda, trying to influence young minds, creating excitement, encouraging younger generation and young people to riot, teaching them ways to make explosive materials, are completely clear for all to see. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "The passivity and reactivity of the enemy's movement is that the Iranian nation made significant progress and advancement in a short period of time, and this was exactly what the enemies of this nation did not want. By plotting and spending money, they brought in people, including some politicians, in the United States, Europe, and other places." Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei emphasized, "These massive movements showed that the Iranian nation, besides being cheerful, religious, and adhering to spiritual values, the country also continues its movement forward, its advancement and progress." The leader considered the presence of millions of young people in the Arba'in procession and religious movement as an example of piety, religious belief, and the great movement of the Iranian nation. He added, "In fact, the initiative was in the hands of the Iranian nation, and the enemy was forced to react clumsily and stupidly, and they planned this disturbance and rioting." The leader of the Islamic Revolution emphasized that the different ruling for those who came to the streets and noted, "Some of these people were either the enemy's agents, or, if they were not enemy's agents, they were in the same direction as the enemy. Some are emotional individuals. In the case of the second category, cultural work needs to be done. But regarding the first category, the judiciary and security officials should do their duties." Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "Some people say the atmosphere should not turn into a security atmosphere, and I generally agree with this point of view as much as possible. But nonetheless, I would say that the judiciary and security forces need to perform their duties." He emphasized, "As long as the Iranian nation holds the flag of Islam high and is with the Islamic system, these hostilities from evil hegemonic powers will continue, and the only way and the only solution is to resist." However, he said, "It is incorrect to say that moving on the path of Islam has created trouble for us, because these evil hegemonic powers are opposed to the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic, and this is clear for all to see."
Start. Movement. Speed. Living Hope. Toward the Peak. On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon me. I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته My dear sisters and brothers from all around the world I hope you're doing well You are hearing my voice from IRIB English Radio We're at Youth Station And I'm really honored today to be here at your service And with me I have my dear friend, Sister Asma
Yes
Hello, my dear sister
Wassalamu alaikum, dear listeners Yes, I'm happy to be here once more
It's a big pleasure
Youth Station is my favorite cozy corner
Me too
Yes.
Yeah, and I hope all the listeners will enjoy it too.
Of course.
You know, today we have a topic about learning something better and faster.
So good. She's a doctor and she has a lot to say about that.
No, it's a long way to be a doctor and I have to go to, you know, through a lot of things in this world.
Still, you're but a doctor.
No, I'm not a doctor.
Okay, you're an assiduous student. Please share with us.
Yes. You know what? Learning a thing in life is a huge part of everybody's lives. Mm-hmm. From the moment you were born to the moment you die, there are many things that you have to learn. And, yeah. You know, learning is not only something just consciously, you know. Sometimes this learning from the environment is not by your own will. You are learning something that you don't know that you're learning. And
now things are getting complicated.
Yes. I haven't elaborated more
Do
for you.
Do elaborate.
Yeah. And all the listeners, dear listeners, you know, the thing is, this will have always, you know, be there for you. You have to strive, you know, you have to always be striving to grow better in this life. And one of the best ways to grow better is learning new things. You know what? But whether you are learning a language, math, or anything, there are some ways to learn better. And these ways are so, you know, different that I cannot just, for example, tell you, Asma, if you do that, you will actually learn better. No, because you are a different and special individual that I cannot decide what can
Yeah, everyone
be, you know
is
what?
So different from the other.
Yeah.
But now, just let me ask you a question before we get into that. Do you think it's something biological, something that you have been bestowed with through your genes or DNA?
No, no, at all. Yeah, I know. There are IQ and, you know, there is, you know, intelligence, IQ,
exactly,
and everything that will help you to be better in a way. But it's not that much, I think, effective.
But it has some sort of effect.
It has.
You know, those who have a higher IQ will learn things in an easier way.
But if you go and search through the history and see some people that are really famous around the world, like, I don't know, Thomas Edison, who has invented the electricity.
Yeah, electricity.
You know what? He was, I think, he was called a stupid person, you know, when he was at a young age. But what happened to him?
Yes, but he was ahead of his age, you know what I mean? Maybe
I know.
The teachers were stupid.
But, you know, IQ is not something that is affected by age. As you know, we have some geniuses, you know, and child prodigies that they are like, okay, when they are 3 years old, they can understand the music. They can write the music. Yeah, I'm not talking about that a special case. I'm talking about the majority of all the persons in the society.
So let's get it straight.
Yeah.
IQ is going to have some effect on your learning process. Those who have a higher IQ will learn things quite easier.
And faster.
And faster. Of course. So they are some sort of way ahead of the others in the competition. But still we know that we can improve our learning process through too much of methods.
Yeah. And also, if you just go through the people who are really smart and have a higher IQ than other people, they are more, you know, they are lazier.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're like, okay, I will learn it faster, so why should I try?
Yeah, exactly.
And exactly this is the reason that people who has the lower IQ but try more will be more successful.
Exactly. Now I agree.
Yeah.
That's very true.
Yeah. So, I'm going to talk about the ways, if you do agree with me.
Of course. Let's get into it.
First of all, I want to tell you that if you act more classical in this area, you will be more successful. What do I mean by more classical? Learning in a classical way is better for you. For example, when you go to online classes, you will understand that your productivity will be lower than when you are...
Will be reduced, actually, yeah. That's
physically
very much true.
You're in the class.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Why is it like that? Because it is like that. Because our brain system, we cannot just
because
fake it.
Because it's pretty natural. When you see the teacher, when you just feel the book, when you interact with your friends, when you have a discussion with people, when you disagree and agree and improve that discussion, plenty much of things would be deduced from that class.
You know, I just don't want to be the one who act like a knowledgeable person, but it is just my experience.
Yeah, yeah. As a student,
as a student, I'm just... I want you to be more classical in this way. And just, for example, don't use the computer to write or to take note. Use the paper and the pen and a pencil.
I love that too.
Me too.
That's the easiest possible way to learn things.
Exactly. And, you know, you feel the knowledge in this way.
Yeah.
And, it's like you are touching it. And this feeling of touching knowledge will help you to love it.
I feel like Plato is writing.
Yeah. This is so nice. And but another thing is that how you take note. Taking note effectively is another matter which is really important in this area of studying. I want to ask you, how just you take note when you're in a class or when you're learning something new?
Well, my studying process is a bit of difficult because I go through too much of studying, and then after I study a chapter or so, I will pick a paper. And then whatever that comes into my mind, like a brainstorming that has remained in my mind from whatever I've read, I will write them on a paper. And then I will make headlines. And after that headlines, I will make some subdivisions in order to know the other categories that are related into that topic. And then if there is needed, I would write some notes behind every single little thing in order to have some important points.
Yeah, I understand.
To have in mind.
I understand it. But, you know, the thing is, if I want to be honest with you, I'm not that kind of person to take notes.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, sitting there and looking at the eyes of the teacher and be like, okay, I'm not a clown, but I'm just listening to you. And it is my way. You know, you shouldn't force yourself to do something which seems correct, but you don't like it. I think being okay with the way you are in is the most important part of learning something. Mm-hmm. When you're okay, when you're satisfied with the way you are learning something, you will learn it perfectly.
Now tell me, Vita. I'm studying and my mind is circling and it's not there. How should I have that mind back? How should I concentrate on a thing?
There are many ways. First of all, I want to tell you the logical way that all of the psychologists tell other people to do that. It is that you have to write in that moment. You know, you have to find a piece of paper, then just put, you know, I mean, take your pencil and start writing about the thoughts that is bothering you. You know what? When you write it, your mind is somehow free, you know? And you feel like, okay, right now my mind is in peace, and you can tear out,
that paper.
That paper and just put it in the...
garbage basket.
Yeah, exactly.
Throw it in the river.
But this method just doesn't work on me.
I feel that wouldn't work on me as well.
And but the thing is, when I'm like that,
I'm
and I cannot
a machine,
concentrate,
you know, it's not like I'm writing that on paper and it's gone.
It's somehow cliche and so ideal to be real.
Yeah.
But my own special method, which always worked for me, is that I just try to read the thing I'm reading louder. It's like, okay, I imagine like I'm in the classroom and I'm the teacher, I'm a student.
And after about 1 hour, everything is done.
Yeah, exactly.
My brain is back.
Even at first, I cannot understand what I'm reading aloud.
Yeah, yeah, you know? That's very true.
It's like I'm just reading the words, and these words have no meaning. But after maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes, it will be okay.
Yeah.
This is the best method for
me. I will concentrate.
Yeah.
Let's go for a short break, and we'll be back in no time. Thank you for listening.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back. One of the ways to get back our concentration on the thing that we're reading is to read the stuff that you're reading with a louder voice.
And there is another way that you can try, but I think this way somehow needs a strong imagination. You know what?
Yeah.
You have to be like, connect what you're thinking with what you're learning. Sometimes you're thinking about something and this thought, you know, doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it comes from the thing you are reading. For example, you're reading something and these things just turn on a light in your brain and you're thinking about something else and else and else and else. And this road has a root. You have to try to find this root and connect these two things together. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah. And this is somehow difficult for me because I don't have that much, you know, strong imagination about many things.
Well, I have a strong imagination, but still that doesn't work because my imagination would take me somewhere very much far away.
Yeah, you cannot find a route of this
exactly.
imagination.
Yeah, exactly. There would be different roads and then I'd be lost between them all.
Yeah, I do agree with that. And I think this would work for the person who has a kind of middle-level imagination.
The same thing that works with the paper and writing things out of your brain into that paper, the same people would do this
exactly,
thing as well.
I think. Too.
I guess that would be useful for them.
And, you know, I was talking about connection and something just kind of was reminded for me. That is, sometimes you're learning something that is not familiar, you know?
Yeah.
You are not connected to that in real world. For example, in biology that we read, there are many parts, you know?
Yes.
The body parts, I don't know, plants and something. The body parts is always easier for us.
Exactly.
Why is it like
because
that?
It's because, tangible.
Yeah, exactly.
I can see my fingers and how does it work?
Exactly. And also, for example, when we were studying about heart or something, it is more difficult than, for example, when we're talking about bone, skin or something, which is touchable. You can touch it. You can see it. And this will help you
We brought a heart into class and we touched it.
Yeah, exactly. And these are
a heart of a ship, of course.
What?
A heart of a ship, of course.
Of course, and sometimes cow or something.
Yeah.
But I always
so another
wanted to...
way of learning easier is to make things tangible and real. Yeah.
Yeah, I do agree with that one, but this one is somehow difficult.
Difficult in physics or in things like more
there
difficult.
There are many topics, for example, like physics, like language, like many things that it cannot
even
touch.
Psychology.
Psychology, many things.
Sociology, psychology, and things like that. Whatever that is related to humanity, you cannot bring it out and work on it. The only thing is to think about it and to get engaged in it.
Mm-hmm. And I saw many people that were used to this method, where used to always see something and then learn it. And used to, you know, they were used to, you know, just being so real. And after a while, they couldn't really understand the matters like physics or math that weren't that much tangible or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big problem, I think.
Do you think age would matter?
Yes. Yes. I think.
Yeah.
For example...
Unfortunately, I think so as well.
Yeah. And even, especially language learning.
Yeah, and language learning.
Age is something so important.
Yeah.
For example, there are some people who tell you, okay, if you are under the age of 7, you can learn a language as your mother tongue. I do not agree with that sort of thing because we have many languages like French, which has a really complicated grammar.
Yeah.
And this complicated grammar, learning this complicated grammar is impossible for a child.
The process of conjugation is so difficult.
Yeah, exactly. And this child, you know, has to learn the mother tongue, then go for the second language at the higher ages, you know?
Mm-hmm. I guess after the age of 12, you can learn different languages pretty much easy until 20 or 25. That would be an easy process. I have seen plenty much of people who have done this language learning at an age, just the age that I mentioned for you, and they were so much successful.
Yeah,
and
of
course. They have managed to learn different languages this way.
But it's not like the age is that much the big problem.
Yes, I know.
You know what?
I know,
For example, even if you're a 50-year-old or you are 45, you can learn the language easily, but you have to put more effort on that.
Yeah, that's very true. If you have a driving force, if you have enough of motivation, and if you have the urge to learn, everything is going to be pretty much easier. And you would devote too much of time for that, too much of energy and hard working, and it's going to be easier.
So, dear listeners, this is all the time we have for today's discussion. There are many methods, but the thing is, the key point is your effort. your desire
your
to learn
hard working is the key point.
Exactly. So I hope you all enjoy our conversation of today. Thank you for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB.